Okay, welcome. This is episode 75 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. This episode will be targeted towards preparation for step 3 and the medicine and training exam. And I will say because I closely try to follow the curriculum from the American Board of Internal Medicine, this will also potentially help for the medicine board exams. And today I'm going to primarily be covering endocrinology. The thing I will say is I've done some reflection since I made the first series in the podcast. And again, just thinking more about concerns of being efficient, being more timely, and being as targeted as possible in the reviews. So I'm going to change things around with this podcast. I will still try to cover the same amount of material. Obviously, I'm not going to recover the same thing I already covered in the first part of this series. But I'll cover new material today, but I'll use a slightly different approach to try to be a little more efficient with my coverage. So today I'll just keep discussing a lot of scenarios and interspersing the content as we go along. So this will be more conversational. So the first thing I'll tackle today is a Whipple's triad, right? So Whipple's triad, you've heard of this. It's one of the easiest triads to memorize in all of medicine, right? So basically, it's like the person is hypoglycemic. They have symptoms of hypoglycemia, and then those symptoms improve with the administration of glucose, right? And the thing is, classically, why would you want to think about Whipple's triad for exams? You want to think about Whipple's triad in the context of three high-yield causes of like neuroglycopenic symptoms, right? So, for example, the classic exam scenario is to try to differentiate between a person that's injecting insulin or a person that has an insulinoma, or a person that is factitiously taking a sulfonylurea to create symptoms of hypoglycemia, right? So clearly, if a patient is injecting insulin, the insulin that you can buy in a store, or at least in a pharmacy, does not have a C-peptide in it, right? So the person's insulin will be high, the C-peptide will not be elevated, right? And you basically tell the person, you know, stop doing that. And again, you just give them glucose and they should get better. If a person is has an insulinoma, right, so think about it probably like in the context of an MEN1 syndrome, they will have, again, the hypoglycemia, they will have high levels of insulin, but their C-peptide would also be elevated, right, because the insulin that's causing their symptoms is endogenous to the body. Whenever you have an endogenous increase in the release of insulin, your C-peptide will be elevated at the same time. For insulinomas, I mean, classically, you can give like diazoxide as treatment. Diazoxide is a drug that's very good at opening up potassium channels. If you remember from med school, whenever you open up potassium channels, especially in the pancreatic beta cells, that will prevent the pancreatic beta cell from depolarizing, and that will shut down the release of insulin. Alternatively, you can give an alkylating agent known as streptozocin. Streptozocin is a very good drug for the treatment of insulinomas. Although, obviously, if you could do surgery to pull out the tumor, that will also be an ideal outcome there. So your insulin and C-peptide levels are elevated if a person has an insulinoma. Now, if a person is taking a sulfonylurea, right? Sulfonylureas, right, their mechanism of action, they block that potassium channel again that you find in the pancreatic beta cells. The cell depolarizes, you squirt out a ton of insulin. As you're squirting out that insulin, C-peptide is also released, right? So you may ask yourself, Divine, how do I differentiate between a person that's taking a sulfonylurea and a person that's injecting insulin? Well, you do a sulfonylurea screen, right? So you can basically check their urine for like a sulfonylurea, like meglidinide metabolites. Meglidinides are basically drugs that work like sulfonylureas. They're just shorter acting. So you can check for those metabolites in the urine, and that should be able to solve whatever dilemma. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a person that has an insulinoma, right? And you're thinking about diagnostic testing. So the thing is, first thing is, right, you want to go ahead and confirm that they have an insulinoma first, right? So you do that testing, and then after that you need to do like some kind of scanning of the abdomen, right? So you do like a CT scan of the abdomen to detect the insulinoma, and then you should be good to go with that, right? So the insulin will be high, the C-peptide levels will be high, and then you just do an abdominal CT scan to localize the lesion. Now, what if you get a question about a person that gets kind of dizzy after a meal, and let's assume they recently had like a gastric bypass surgery, right? So whenever you see stuff like that, then you're thinking more about a person that, because I mean, this is something that happens classically after a person gets gastric bypass surgery. They have like very quick reabsorption of whatever they consume. So for those people, that postprandial hypoglycemia they get, you would want to recommend eating smaller meals, and you actually want to recommend meals that have like more, I guess think of it as a more like balanced meal, right? So a meal that contains like proteins and carbs and fat and stuff like that. You just sort of want them to have meals that may not necessarily cause just such a huge insulin surge after they eat. So small meals, more frequent, smaller meals, but again, meals that are not just predominantly carbohydrate, just have meals that have a mix of other things besides just the straight up carbs. Now, let's assume you get a question about a person. So again, this is all endocrine. You get a question about like an old guy and his hats don't fit anymore and he has like bone pain and hearing problems. I'm really hoping that with this, you're thinking about Paget's disease. Paget's disease classically presents in this way, right? And basically, the thing that happens with Paget's disease is that you have like, sort of like disorganized remodeling of bone. And I mean, if you want to make the diagnosis, right, the diagnosis classically, you want to do something called a bone scan. A bone scan will show you those weird lesions that characteristically define a person having a Paget's disease. Occasionally, if a patient has like really bad bone pain, you can also do an x-ray of that region that they have the bone pain in. But I'll tell you that the big test you want to order if a patient has Paget's disease on exams is a bone scan. And I mean, if a patient is asymptomatic and they have Paget's, you don't need to do any kind of treatment. But if they are symptomatic, you want to go ahead and give them a bisphosphonate. Bisphosphonates are the treatment of choice for Paget's disease. And don't forget that Paget's disease, right, is associated with a person having osteosarcoma. Paget's disease is actually a risk factor for the development of osteosarcoma. Don't forget that there are some drugs like a teriparatide that also increase a person's risk of osteosarcoma. And also there is having like an RB gene mutation, right, also does increase a person's risk of osteosarcoma. Now, Paget's disease, right, classically on labs, there's no abnormality. The only abnormality is usually just an elevation in the person's alkaline phosphatase. And I mean, if you do imaging, you may see like the hair on end appearance to the bone, right? Like a cotton wool appearance to the skull. Remember that you can also find that appearance in a person that has like severe hemolytic disease from like thalassemia, for example. And because people that have a Paget's disease, right, they have like hypervascular bone marrow, they can ultimately develop high output heart failure. So Paget's disease is just one of those things you kind of want to pay attention to. And it's also, again, very commonly tested on exams. Now, let's talk about some more scenarios here, right? So let's assume a person has like a fat soluble vitamin deficiency, right? So hopefully you remember your fat soluble vitamins, right? Those are vitamins like A, D, E, and K, right? So if you have a vitamin K deficiency, you could bleed. If you have a vitamin E deficiency, right, you can have problems with your cerebellum. If you have a vitamin D deficiency, you have like secondary hyperparathyroidism. You can have like osteomalacia. If you're an adult, you can have rickets if you're a kid. And if you have a vitamin A deficiency, right, you can have like night blindness. So what are the classic things on exams, on like the in-training exam or step 3 of the medicine boards that cause vitamin D deficiency, right? So one classic one is celiac disease, right? Celiac disease, pretty classic, right? So these people, remember celiac disease has a predilection for the small intestine, especially the terminal ileum, right? So remember it's the terminal ileum that is the primary site of reabsorption of those fat-soluble vitamins. So you can run into trouble there. Also, think about a person that has like pancreatic insufficiency, like a patient with cystic fibrosis, right? Because they cannot make pancreatic enzymes, they cannot emulsify fat, so they cannot reabsorb fat-soluble vitamins. So those people can also get into trouble. Another classic situation is a patient that has Crohn's, right? Again, remember, Crohn's has a predilection for the terminal ileum, so that can sort of lead those people towards those problems, right? And I just said that if a person has vitamin D deficiency, right, they can have like a secondary hyperparathyroidism, right? So it begs the question that how would you differentiate? I guess this would be another nice exam scenario. How do you differentiate between chronic kidney disease and chronic liver disease as the cause of secondary hyperparathyroidism? The thing you want to do under those circumstances is to check the phosphate, right? So let's deal with each scenario one by one. The thing is, if a patient has chronic kidney disease, right, as the cause of their secondary hyperparathyroidism, the mechanism there is that they don't have 1-alpha-hydroxylase working, right? So if you don't have 1-alpha-hydroxylase working, you cannot make active vitamin D. You cannot make calcitriol. And if you don't make calcitriol, you will not reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut, right? So you'll be hypocalcemic. If you're hypocalcemic, your vitamin D, your PTH levels will go up, right? And we know PTH is known as the phosphate trashing hormone, right? So you would expect that your phosphate should go down in chronic kidney disease, in secondary hyperparathyroidism. But the thing is, if that secondary hyperparathyroidism is arising from CKD, then your phosphorus will actually be high because the primary phosphorus excreting organ of your body is your kidney. So if your kidneys are not working, your phosphate is not going to go down. So in CKD induced the secondary hyperparathyroidism, your PTH is high, your calcium is low, but your phosphate is actually high because you cannot get rid of it. Contrast that with chronic liver disease, right? So if you look at normal vitamin D metabolism, you bathe in the sun, and then there is an enzyme in the liver that helps you make calcidiol. That's like 25 hydroxy vitamin D. And then you go to the kidneys, and then that calcidiol is converted to 125 dihydroxy vitamin D, also called calcitriol. So if your liver is not working, you're not going to create feedstock for the kidney, for the kidneys that 1-alpha hydroxylase to work on. So actually, chronic liver disease, right? So like cirrhosis can also cause a vitamin D deficiency, right? And the associated secondary hyperparathyroidism. Only big thing there is that, so let's sort of walk through this, right? So you're not making the vitamin D. If you're not making the vitamin D, again, you will not reabsorb calcium and phosphate in your gut, so your blood calcium levels will be low, so your PTH will go up. If your PTH goes up, right, your phosphate should be trashed, right? And because your kidneys are working well, your phosphate will be appropriately trashed. So in secondary hyperparathyroidism arising from chronic liver disease, your calcium is low, your PTH is high, okay? But your phosphate will be low because your kidneys are working. Very high yield to know and understand that those are two scenarios. Now, again, vitamin D, actually, I guess I will just say this, right, since I'm talking about calcidiol. Actually, if you want to assess a person's vitamin D status, measuring their calcidiol levels, right, so their 25 hydroxy vitamin D levels, is actually the best measure, okay, of assessing a patient's vitamin D status. And then, person has vitamin D deficiency, right? If, for example, they have CKD, you want to give them calcitriol as treatment, right? And then you can give like a 25 hydroxy vitamin D as treatment for patients that have a chronic liver disease to sort of fix their secondary hyperparathyroidism. Now, let's talk about osteoporosis, right? So osteoporosis is a very big topic for these three exams that we're targeting here. And the first thing you want to know with osteoporosis, first things first, are your screening guidelines, right? So if a woman is more than 65 years old, right, you want to go ahead and screen her with a DEXA scan, right? The key value you're looking for is a T-score having been less than negative 2.5. If your T-score is less than negative 2.5, that defines osteoporosis, and you go ahead and treat. But the thing is, they know that most people have memorized that guideline, so they begin to present some atypical guidelines on exams for people that are potentially less than 65 years old, but also deserve screening for osteoporosis. Now, the big ones you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind are people that, for example, have like anorexia nervosa. Those people certainly deserve osteoporosis screening before the age of 65. If a person has a primary hyperparathyroidism, remember, if high levels of PTH literally leaches away at your bone. If those people are less than 65, they also deserve screening for osteoporosis. If a patient has been on steroids for a very long period of time, so say, for example, for like an autoimmune disease or for a rheumatologic disorder, those people certainly deserve screening for osteoporosis, again, with a DEXA scan. Or if a person is like a long-term smoker, right? So let's say they've smoked for a very long period of time. Smoking causes problems with bone reabsorption, so you can also get osteoporosis that way. So those people, again, deserve screening. Another classic one is a person that has like a history of hyperthyroidism. Again, remember, thyroid hormone has a direct reabsorbing effect on bone, Okay, so you want to again screen those people for osteoporosis. And I guess another one that's probably a little low yield, but it may show up on an exam, is if, for example, they have like a very strong like family history of like hip fracture, or they've had like fractures that are kind of like weird, right? So it's like you're a person that you just like fell from like a standing height and then you get like a big fracture. Those people potentially also deserve screening for osteoporosis, even if they are less than the age of 65. Now, again, remember, if you're negative 2.5 or lower with DEXA scan, you have osteoporosis. And again, usually in osteoporosis, there are no lab abnormalities, right? So contrast this with Paget's disease, where the alkaline phosphatase may be elevated. Classically, in osteoporosis on exams, there are no lab abnormalities. Again, actually very high yield to know that. And really, why, you may ask yourself, like, Divine, why do so many women get osteoporosis? The thing is, as you get older, right, your ovaries sort of stop working. As your ovaries stop working, you stop making estrogen, right? As you stop making estrogen, at least the very potent estrogen, because, I mean, if you're postmenopausal, you still have a kind of estrogen that's made by your adipocytes under the action of the enzyme known as aromatase. But it's not as potent as the estrogen that comes from your ovaries, right? So once you hit, like, that magic age of, like, 50, your ovaries stop working, then by some mechanism that you probably remember from step one involving osteoprotegrin, your bone begins to resorb, right? So you begin to get into trouble with osteoporosis. Also, if you're a guy, if you have like low testosterone for any reason, that also increases your risk of osteoporosis. And in general, right, if a patient has osteoporosis, you want to go ahead and treat them. And your treatment usually revolves around giving bisphosphonates. I mean, if a patient has that low T-score less than negative 2.5, that's an indication for starting bisphosphonates. If a patient has like a fracture that is deemed to be secondary to osteoporosis, you also want to go ahead and treat those people with bisphosphonates. And there is something called a fracture risk assessment score. It's called like a FRAX score. It's something that can be calculated. If your FRAX score is more than 20%, you also deserve bisphosphonate treatment for osteoporosis. And I mean, again, like I said, bisphosphonates are first line, but don't forget that bisphosphonates have some side effects, right? So if, for example, a person has really bad kidney disease, they probably should not be put on a bisphosphonate. If a person has really bad esophagitis, they also probably should not be started on a bisphosphonate, right? Because remember, bisphosphonates can cause a pill esophagitis. In fact, you need to basically like take them on an empty stomach and you need to stand for like 30 minutes after taking a bisphosphonate and take a lot of fluid so that it does not interact extensively with the esophageal mucosa and cause a lot of trouble. And don't forget that bisphosphonates, right, they can also cause osteonecrosis of the jaw. Okay, so that's one thing you sort of want to avoid with bisphosphonates. If people have like any of these like problems or contraindications I'm mentioning, you probably don't want to start them on a bisphosphonate on exams. And then if a patient obviously cannot tolerate a bisphosphonate, one thing you can consider doing is to give those patients like raloxifene. Right, raloxifen is a great drug. It's a SERM. It kind of works like tamoxifen, but it's kind of different in the sense that, so I guess let me sort of compare and contrast both for you, right? So tamoxifen is a SERM. It's used as chemo prophylaxis for breast cancer, right? It's like an estrogen receptor antagonist in the breast, but it's an agonist in the uterus and bone, right? So because it has like pro-estrogenic activity in bone, it's great for osteoporosis, right? But tamoxifen is not used to treat osteoporosis. Raloxifen can. Okay, raloxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist in the breast, although it's not as great as tamoxifen. But raloxifen, it actually has, it doesn't have the same estrogen agonist activity in the uterus that tamoxifen has. So you actually have no increased risk of endometrial cancer with raloxifen compared with tamoxifen. But raloxifen does have estrogen receptor agonist activity in bone, so it's actually good for osteoporosis. Only problem is it also increases your venous thromboembolic risk, so that's something you sort of want to watch out for. So if, for example, on the exam, again, a patient cannot take bisphosphonates for some reason, you can strongly consider using raloxifen. But in the weird scenario where for some reason your patient cannot take a bisphosphonate, your patient cannot take cannot take a raloxifene. Then one thing you potentially want to consider in your test is starting them on teriparatide. Although again, I will say that teriparatide will be a very rare correct answer on these exams, but it is certainly useful in the treatment of osteoporosis. Now, what are some key things you want to know about teriparatide, right? So the thing is, teriparatide, you give it in a pulsatile fashion. When you give it in a pulsatile fashion, it actually encourages bone production. If you give it in a continuous fashion, it actually encourages bone resorption. Remember, teriparatide is a PTH analog. Now, the thing is, teriparatide, though, there's the risk of tachyphylaxis, right? So after a while, it stops working. In fact, I'll say most times you don't prescribe it for more than 2 years. Because one, it stops working after a while, and two, you're also worried about osteosarcoma with teriparatide, because remember, you're essentially given a growth factor, stimulating factor to bone, right? So you can potentially envisage that causing malignant degeneration of bone, right? So like osteosarcoma. So obviously you don't want that. That's not a reasonable outcome. Now, one thing they may do on exams is they may give you a question about a patient that has like osteoporosis and they're like postmenopausal, but they don't have like hot flashes, they don't have like any like serious postmenopausal symptoms, and then they try to trick you into giving those patients estrogen replacement therapy for osteoporosis. Resist that temptation, okay? The only time you give people estrogen replacement therapy is if they have very severe postmenopausal symptoms. Estrogen replacement therapy is never the right answer as the treatment for osteoporosis. No, that is not a great strategy on exams. You'll get those questions wrong. So just never do that. Now, let's sort of jump to another scenario. Let's assume you get a question about a patient that has a kidney stone, right? And they have a history of MEN1, right? Hopefully you're thinking about a primary hyperparathyroidism, right? Causing like hypercalcemia and like a calcium kidney stone in those people, right? So calcium nephrolithiasis. Remember, MEN1, it arises from like a menin gene mutation. It has autosomal dominant inheritance. And remember that there are three basic antecedents with MEN1, right? So those people can have like primary hyperparathyroidism, right? In fact, the mnemonic is like parapanpit, right? So you can have primary hyperparathyroidism, which is actually the most common presentation of MEN1. They can have pituitary tumors, right? So they can have like a pituitary adenoma. Classically, it's a prolactinoma. Although they can also have like a tumor that's secreting a ton of growth hormone. And then they can also have pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, right? So like they can have like insulinomas. They can have, so they can present with like Whipple's triad. They can have glucagonomas that can present as diabetes, and then like a rash. I mean, the classic boss phrase for the rash on exams is a necrolytic migratory erythema. And then they could also have vipomas, right? Remember, vipomas can present as the WDHA syndrome, right? So where you have like watery diarrhea and they have like a potassium problem, so they can have like hypokalemia, and then they could also stop making gastric acid, right? So achlorhydria, that's the WDHA syndrome that's characteristic of a vipoma. And then alternatively, they can also have a Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, right? So they have a gastrinoma, right? So those people have like virulent ulcers in the stomach, and those ulcers tend to be like in weird locations, right? So like if you see like a distal jejunal ulcer, that's almost like pathognomonic for Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. So if you see kidney stones, a patient with a history of MEN1 syndrome, you're thinking about primary hyperparathyroidism, right? And remember that the most common cause of hypercalcemia, right, like in the US, at least in a patient that is not in the hospital, is primary hyperparathyroidism. And the thing is, in those patients, the most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism is a parathyroid adenoma, okay? But if you want to contrast with a patient that has MEN1 syndrome, the most common cause actually, and this is actually very high yield to know for exams, the most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism in a patient that has MEN1 syndrome is actually a parathyroid hyperplasia, not a parathyroid adenoma, okay? It's kind of like a subtle difference, but it's actually very high yield to know for exams. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that has primary, like has hypercalcemia, and they're an inpatient in the hospital, right? What's the most likely cause under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about malignancy. Malignancy is the most common cause of hypercalcemia in a hospitalized patient, right? So if you see hypercalcemia in the inpatient setting, you need to begin to worry about a potential malignancy causing that hypercalcemia. And I mean, you may say, okay, Divine, how will I differentiate between primary hyperparathyroidism as the cause of a patient's hypercalcemia and like hypercalcemia of malignancy as the cause of a patient's hypercalcemia? Well, one way you can do that is to sort of look at labs, right? So if a patient has primary hyperparathyroidism, obviously their PTH will be high, right? If their PTH is high, their calcium will be high as well. I mean, that's why they are presenting, right? That's why they have the hypercalcemia in the first place. And then their phosphate will be low, right? Because PTH, again, another name, another like a mnemonic, right, for PTH is a phosphate trashing hormone. So if they trash phosphate, right, their phosphate levels will be low, okay? And I guess if you're looking at their levels of calcium in the urine, right, if you have a ton of calcium in your blood, guess what? You're going to have a ton of calcium in your urine, right? So those people will have high levels of urinary calcium, okay? That's what defines those are sort of like the values you observe in a primary hyperparathyroidism. Now, contrast that with hypercalcemia of malignancy, right? So if a patient has hypercalcemia of malignancy, their calcium levels will be high. But the thing is, in hypercalcemia of malignancy, it's not usually PTH itself that causes the hypercalcemia. It can be something else that activates bone resorption that causes that hypercalcemia, right? So for example, say for example, a patient has like a squamous cell cancer of the lungs. That squamous cell cancer of the lung, right, can produce PTHRP, right? So like PTH-related peptide. And that PTHRP, right, I mean, PTH-related peptide, that already tells you what it does. It acts just like PTH, right? So you release a ton of a PTH-like substance that works just like PTH. So you reabsorb bone, right? So you have like elevated calcium levels, you have low phosphate levels, and you would have so high calcium, low phosphate, but those people's PTH levels will actually be low because their PTH will be appropriately suppressed because they have a hypercalcemia. Okay, again, that's a very high yield thing to know for exams. So that's how you differentiate between, again, hypercalcemia of a malignancy, right? Or hypercalcemia arising from primary hyperparathyroidism. I mean, another classic scenario may be like multiple myeloma, right? So in multiple myeloma, right, those people, the plasma cells, they secrete a ton of interleukin-1. In fact, another name from interleukin-1 is osteoclast activating factor, right? So those people directly, again, resorb bone. So their calcium will be high, but their PTH will be low because it will be appropriately suppressed, okay? And if, for example, a patient has primary hyperparathyroidism, right, how do you want to treat those people? In general, you can treat those people with like bisphosphonates, although I will say that for the purposes of your exams, you probably want to go ahead and do a parathyroidectomy. And the thing is, this is one of those annoying things that just pops up on exams all the time, but there are certain indications for parathyroidectomy, right? So you want to know who should get a parathyroidectomy. The classic ones that are tested on exams are people that have that are aged like they're less than 50 years old. So if you have a patient that's less than 50 years old, those people deserve a parathyroidectomy. If you have a patient where their blood calcium levels are more than one, like greater than one, I believe it's like milligrams or grams per deciliter, above like the upper limit of normal, those people also deserve a parathyroidectomy. If a patient is beginning to have like problems from having that hyperparathyroidism, right, so like kidney stones, for example, you'd want to go ahead and recommend a parathyroidectomy for those people. If a patient has They're beginning to have like problems with like creatinine, right? So like they're beginning to have like creatinine elevations from the chronic hypercalcemia, like kidney disease is like beginning to develop. Those people also deserve a parathyroidectomy. If you have a patient that has like osteoporosis from having the primary hyperparathyroidism, those people also deserve a parathyroidectomy for the treatment of that primary hyperparathyroidism. So those are like the classic scenarios you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind for indications for a parathyroidectomy. And then you want to remember that if you perform a parathyroidectomy, right, those people can have like hypocalcemic seizures after the surgery. So that's just something you sort of want to keep your eye on after surgery. Like you don't just send those patients home immediately. Usually you'll send them home with like some kind of like very strong like calcium prescription just to make sure they don't get into trouble, because hypocalcemia can cause lots of problems. It can cause seizures. It can cause a prolonged QT interval. So those are things you all kind of want to watch out. You want to watch out for. And again, I've talked about some high yield scenarios here. Like I've talked about how hypercalcemia can present in the setting of a MEN1 syndrome and also MEN2A, right? And then I've talked about how people could get hypercalcemia or malignancy, right? So classically on exams, you're thinking of like squamous cell cancer of the lungs. You're thinking of multiple myeloma, right? I've talked about like the different values that can help you differentiate between primary hyperparathyroidism and hypercalcemia of malignancy. I guess one sort of odd scenario I want to talk about here is something called familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. So this has relatively similar labs to primary hyperparathyroidism with one key difference, right? So basically, the pathophysiology underlying FHH is that a patient has defects in their calcium sensing receptor, right? So even if they're hypercalcemic, their parathyroid glands do not recognize that maybe it's time to stop making all this parathyroid hormone. So these people actually have high levels of PTH. And because they have high levels of PTH, they will actually have high levels of calcium in their blood. So they will have hypercalcemia, okay? And then these patients, they will also have low levels of phosphate because the PTH appropriately trashes phosphate. But in contrast with primary hyperparathyroidism, where your urinary calcium is high, right? Because again, high levels of calcium in the blood equals high levels of calcium in the urine. In patients with familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, right? I mean, you can even see the name of the disease, hypocalciuric. They actually have low urinary calcium levels. That's actually very high yield to know for exams, because the thing is, the calcium sensing receptor, again, does not recognize that, if you're hypercalcemic, there's no need to reabsorb calcium in the urine. It doesn't listen to those signals. So these people actually reabsorb a ton of their calcium from the urine. So they end up being hypocalciuric. So the urinary calcium is a key distinguishing feature between FHH and primary hyperparathyroidism. The urinary calcium is high in primary hyperparathyroidism. The urinary calcium is low in familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. And if a patient has hypercalcemia and they are taking an antihypertensive medication, hopefully you're thinking about thiazides, right? So remember that your loops lose calcium, but your thiazides retain calcium, right? Thiazides are one of those classic drug causes of hypercalcemia. I mean, what if you also get a question about a patient that is hypercalcemic and they're like an African-American female and they have like symmetric bilateral Hyla lymphadenopathy on a chest x-ray? Well, I hope you're thinking about a sarcoidosis with that. Remember, like the granulomas in sarcoidosis can overexpress a 1-alpha hydroxylase, so they can make a ton of vitamin D, and that can cause a hypercalcemia. If a patient has primary hyperparathyroidism, right, I mean, the way you can do the workup is you measure their blood calcium levels to confirm the hypercalcemia. And I will encourage you to not base your calcium measurement solely on the total serum calcium, right? Because if you have high levels of albumin, that can make your total calcium high, right? The thing you want to do is to measure an ionized calcium, right? The ionized calcium will give you like a very true gauge as to the patient's calcium status, because again, if you have a ton of albumin on board, your total calcium will be high, but your ionized calcium will actually be normal, right? So you don't want to, base your decisions primarily on total calcium. Measure ionized calcium. Once you confirm the hypercalcemia with the ionized calcium, then you can do like a technetium system, EB scan of the parathyroid glands to screen for the adenoma that is potentially causing the primary hyperparathyroidism. And just to round this out, because this is kind of like a high yield topic, let me say a few more things about some things I already mentioned, right? So I said that MEN1, they get like parathyroid problems, they get pancreatic problems, and they get pituitary problems, right? Don't forget MEN2A and 2B, right? So remember that in MEN2A, right, those people can have parathyroid problems, right? So they get the parathyroid hyperplasia, right? And then patients with MEN2A also get pheochromocytomas, right? So they can get pheos. Remember the episodic headache and hypertension. And then those patients can also get medullary thyroid cancer. In fact, medullary thyroid cancer is one of the most common manifestations of MEN2, the MEN2 syndromes, right? So that's sort of something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And it's also inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, and it's associated with a RET gene mutation. MEN2B, somewhat similar findings. They get like the pheochromocytomas, but they don't get like the primary hyperparathyroidism. They get the pheochromocytomas. They get the medullary thyroid cancer. Remember, that has calcitonin as a tumor marker. And then they also get the mucosal neuromas, right? So they get like the neuromas usually around the lip. And then they also tend to have like a marfanoid body habitus. And one high-yield thing I'll say for exams is, if a patient has a history of MEN2, they actually need a prophylactic thyroidectomy, because they will almost certainly get, their chances of getting a medullary thyroid cancer is like 100%. It's just a matter of when. Okay, so those people actually need a prophylactic thyroidectomy so that they don't get medullary thyroid cancer. And then I also talked about multiple myeloma, right? Obviously, for multiple myeloma, you want to do like your SPEP and UPEP to make the diagnosis, right? And remember, multiple myeloma, you can treat it with drugs like bortezomib. That's a proteasome inhibitor. And you can also give thalidomide, right? You may say, oh, divine, thalidomide, birth defects. Why are you giving it to a person? The thing is, the people that get multiple myeloma tend to be old people, right? So those people are usually like past the age of childbearing, right? So those are situations where thalidomide is fine. The clinical benefit sort of outweighs the risks under those circumstances. And then there is one weird calcium disorder as well that, again, makes its way to exams. If you notice, I've probably been spending like the last 20 minutes talking about like calcium problems, but these are all things that you could potentially see on these exams. And there's this condition known as a pseudo hypoparathyroidism, right? Basically, the pathophysiology of this disorder is that these people have like resistance to PTH. So they have a ton of PTH on board, but the second messenger system for PTH just doesn't work. So their PTH levels are high, but they have like a hypoparathyroid state, if you may. In fact, pseudo hypoparathyroidism is a cause of hypocalcemia, not hypercalcemia, right? So these people, right, that have pseudo hypoparathyroidism, you check their PTH levels, it's high, right? But even if their PTH is high, their calcium is actually low because they're not getting any PTH effect. And it should make sense that their phosphorus should be normal or high because, again, they're not getting any sort of phosphate trashing effect from PTH. And one weird thing that you may see on exams with pseudo hypoparathyroidism is measuring the cyclic AMP levels in the urine. The urine cyclic AMP is actually high in primary hyperparathyroidism because PTH uses cyclic AMP as part of its second messenger system. But if a patient has pseudo hypoparathyroidism, because they are not getting the effect of parathyroid hormone, their urinary cyclic AMP activity is actually pretty low. So that's actually a very useful test to delineate primary hyperparathyroidism, where the urinary cyclic AMP is high, from pseudo hypoparathyroidism, where the urinary cyclic AMP is low, Okay, that's one of those tests. This is just one of those questions that most people will get wrong on a test, but hopefully you don't get it wrong because you hopefully are listened to this podcast and actually are paid attention. And again, like I said, right, you do a parathyroidectomy in general for primary hyperparathyroidism. I mean, if the patient is like a bad surgical candidate, that's where you can consider like a bisphosphonate, or you can consider like this drug. It actually modulates like the calcium sensing receptors in a calcet. It can actually be used for the treatment of a primary hyperparathyroidism. It decreases the endogenous release of a parathyroid hormone from the parathyroid gland. Now, what if a patient comes in and they have like severe symptoms from their hypercalcemia? So let's say they're like volume down, and they're like obtunded, and they have like severe abdominal pain and polyuria and all that stuff. How do you treat those people? The thing is, your treatment of choice is the first thing you always want to do, both clinically and on exams, is to give them a ton of fluid, give them a ton of normal saline. Okay, and then as you're giving them that ton of normal saline, you can also give them a furosemide, right? So Lasix, remember, that's a loop diuretic. Remember, loops lose calcium. So that can sort of cause like a calcium diuresis to help them with their hypercalcemia. Alternatively, you can also give those people calcitonin. Calcitonin is actually a great drug for very quickly lowering a person's serum blood calcium levels, okay? So it's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, one thing though, if a patient has hypercalcemia and that hypercalcemia is arising from like sarcoidosis or like multiple myeloma, steroids are actually excellent, like an excellent choice for those, for these particular scenarios, because the thing is, sarcoidosis responds to steroids, and multiple myeloma actually does respond to steroids. I mean, it doesn't respond great, but it responds somewhat. So that hypercalcemia from multiple myeloma can be treated very effectively with steroids. And to sort of like tee things up before we sort of move on here, let's sort of talk about hypocalcemia for a bit. So hypocalcemia, right, can arise from, I just told you that hypercalcemia can arise with hyperparathyroidism. Well, hypocalcemia can arise with hypoparathyroidism, right? And I mean, if you want to ask yourself, what is the thing that commonly causes hypoparathyroidism in the US? It just arises if you screw up in surgery, right? So if you're having like thyroid surgery for any reason, and then by some mistake, although this doesn't happen commonly, you devascularize the parathyroid glands, right? You basically knock out your parathyroid glands, right? And then you can sort of get into trouble with a hypoparathyroidism. I mean, what if they give you a scenario about a patient that is like a newborn, has like truncus arteriosus, has like cleft lip, has like hypocalcemic seizures, and let's assume like they have like cell-mediated like immune deficiency. Hopefully you're thinking about like the George syndrome. Remember, that's a chromosome 22 Q11 defect, right? It's called like the catch-22 disorder. That can classically present with a primary hypoparathyroidism, right? Because for those people, the third and fourth pharyngeal pouches do not develop properly. So they lose their thymus and they also lose their parathyroid glands. And what if you get a question about a patient that is hypocalcemic, and their hypocalcemia arose because let's assume they were like found down. Let's say they were like an alcoholic and they were found down for a long period of time, and you check their creatinine, it's like super high and they have hypocalcemia, right? So what's causing that hypocalcemia? Well, hopefully you're thinking about rhabdomyolysis, right? Remember, rhabdomyolysis can causes like myocyte necrosis, right? So as they have that myocyte necrosis, they spill a lot of potassium into the serum. So those people can actually have like hyperkalemia and like bad problems with hyperkalemia. But another thing they can have is hypocalcemia, because those dead muscle cells can sequester calcium. Okay, so those people, you need to basically, if a patient has rhabdo, you need to place them on telemetry, right? Because with the hyperkalemia they have, they can have like peak T waves, they can have the white QRS complexes that can progress to asystole and death, which is not ideal, obviously. Another thing that can happen is they can have like problems with hypocalcemia, right? So remember, hypocalcemia can prolong a person's QT interval, and that can ultimately cause a torsade de pointe, again, which is not a good arrhythmia to have. I guess while I'm even on the topic, right, any major electrolyte disorder that has hypo in the name, okay, can cause prolonged QT interval and torsade de pointe, right? So like hypokalemia can cause a prolonged QT interval. Hypomagnesemia can cause a prolonged QT interval, okay? And if you have prolonged QT, again, that can cause a torsade de pointe. Now, what if you get a weird question about a patient that has just recurrent thrush, you know, and they have like a primary adrenal insufficiency, right? So they have like really bad Addison's, and then they also have like hypoparathyroidism. If you see this, I really hope you're thinking about this weird disorder. It's called autoimmune polyglandular syndrome, okay? At least type 1. There is a type 2, but the big one that is tested on exams is type 1. Type 1 is where you observe the triad of... So in the type 1, right, they usually have like the chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis. That's why they have the thrush that I described in the Q-stem. And then they can have all these other like weird autoimmune diseases, right? So they can have like hypoparathyroidism, like an autoimmune hypoparathyroidism that can cause hypocalcemia. They can get vitiligo, right? They can get like premature ovarian failure, right? They can get Addison's disease with that. Versus, I guess, the type 2 form of autoimmune polyglandular syndrome, where, again, they can also have the hypoparathyroidism, but these people can also have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. In fact, I want you to associate Hashimoto's thyroiditis more with APS type 2 versus APS type 1. These patients can also have, like, Graves' disease. They can have, diabetes, like type 1 diabetes, right? Because remember, that's an autoimmune insulitis, basically. So they can have many of those problems. But usually, the chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis does not arise with APS type 2. So let me try to make this clear for you. If you see hypoparathyroidism, and you see vitiligo, and you see chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis, think about APS type 1. If you see hypoparathyroidism, and you see like Graves' disease, and you see like Hashimoto's thyroiditis with no chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis, I really want you to think more about APS type 2. The pathophysiology probably doesn't matter much for the exams you're going to be worried about. It's probably just for step 3. You may want to think of these disorders as arising from like an AIR gene mutation. It's like AIRE. Basically, it's I think it's like a transcription factor that ultimately helps you present like the antigens from your endocrine glands in utero, like in the process of like embryology. So if you have a mutation in that enzyme, you don't present these antigens in utero. So your body recognizes them as foreign. So your body begins to destroy those different endocrine organs specifically. But again, I don't really see them testing that pathophysiology on exams. But I guess I'll just throw that in there just in case it wildly shows up on step 3 for some bizarre reason. Now, one other thing I guess you want to keep at the back of your mind with hypocalcemia, right, is if a patient is hypomagnesemic, if you're repleting their calcium may actually not replete appropriately. That's another problem with potassium as well. Basically, if you have MAG problems, your calcium and your potassium will not replete as they should. Okay. And again, remember, if a patient is hypoparathyroid, right, their PTH obviously will be low. If their PTH is low, their calcium will be low. If their PTH is low, their phosphorus will be high, right? That's like easy. But if a patient has, again, pseudo hypoparathyroidism, as I described already, their PTH is high, but their calcium is low, okay, and their phosphorus is high, okay? They have high levels of PTH, but PTH does not work, okay? And I've talked about how you can treat like the hypocalcemia that arises with like chronic kidney disease. I said give calcitriol, right? Versus if a patient had like chronic liver disease, you give like calcidiol. And so let's, I guess, sort of switch out of calcium land and begin to talk about some more endocrine disorders, right? So let's talk about, what if you get a question about a patient that has like episodic headache and hypertension, right? That's pretty classic for a pheochromocytoma, right? Basically, the pathophase here involves like a neuro cells, right, like your chromaffin cells, usually in the adrenal medulla, producing a lot of catecholamines, right, so like epinephrine, norepinephrine. And it's actually very high yield to know for step three that those chromaffin cells that line your adrenal medulla come from the neural crest. And those chromaffin cells have nicotinic acetylcholine receptors on their surfaces, because remember, they're essentially a modified kind of postganglionic sympathetic neuron. Okay, that is more for step three. It's not something that I see showing up on an in-training exam or a medicine board exam. Well, if it showed up though, you'll get it right, because again, you hopefully have paid attention and listened to this podcast. Now, pheochromocytoma actually has associations with a few like syndromes, right? So like neurofibromatosis type 2 has an association with pheo. Von Hippel-Lindau, right? So VHL, I believe that's like a chromosome 3 defect. That also is associated with pheos, right? Remember, VHL is also associated with a brain tumor known as hemangioblastoma. It's just one of those bizarre things you want to keep in mind for exams. And then pheos can actually also be observed in the MEN syndromes, right? Especially like MEN2A and MEN2B, okay? So just one of those, again, high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And I mean, obviously, if you want to make the diagnosis, right, the first thing you do is you measure the levels of like catecholamine breakdown products, right? So like menonephrines, like VHA, VMA, you can measure those levels in the urine or in the serum. And then if those levels are elevated, you're like, maybe this person has a pheo. So you try to localize the lesion by doing like a CT or an MRI of the abdomen. Right. Usually that will help you find the lesion. You may find it like in the adrenal medulla, or you can find it like in a classic location where you may occasionally see these like neural-based tumors. So, for example, in the posterior mediastinum, pheochromocytoma can actually show up in the posterior mediastinum. Now, one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind though is, what if you're like, wait, the metanephrines are high, but you do a CAT scan, you do an MRI of the abdomen, you're not finding the tumor. One thing you may want to proceed to is something called an MIBG scan. The MIBG scan is very specific for cells that neural origin that produce like a ton of catecholamines. So if you do that MIBG scan, it can actually help you localize a pheochromocytoma. I mean, it's an esoteric test, and I mean, it's very rarely done in the real world. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen it done. But if your CT or your MRI of the abdomen fails you with regards to localizing the pheo, you could actually proceed to that MIBG scan. It's a very nice radiological study. It localizes very specifically to pheochromocytomas. Now, how do you treat a pheo, right? I mean, you obviously want to do some kind of surgical resection, but the surgical resection is not the high-yield treatment that shows up on exams. The high-yield treatment that really does show up on exams is what you do pre-op, right? So the thing is, for those patients, it's almost like an overdosing on cocaine sort of scenario, right? Because they'll classically want to trick you on exams into doing like beta blockade for these patients first. Trust me, that is not the right thing you want to do. It's just like the classic step one question. Oh, patient overdoses on cocaine. What do you want to do for them? Right? You don't want to give them a beta blocker. That's a bad idea. They'll have like the unopposed alpha effect. They'll have like severe hypertension, and then they can get like a hypertensive stroke and die. You don't want to do that, right? I guess so. Since I mentioned cocaine, you want to give benzos. Benzos are the first line treatment for a cocaine overdose. But back to this, since we're talking more about endocrine and not psych here. If a patient has a pheo and you want to send them to surgery, like 2 weeks before surgery, usually like 2 weeks before surgery, you want to give them like an alpha blocker first, right? So like you want to give them like phenoxybenzamine. Phenoxybenzamine is an irreversible inhibitor of alpha 1 receptors, right? So you block that alpha receptor so that you don't have those unopposed alpha effects. And then if you block those alpha receptors, then if you want to do beta blockade, fine, that's fine, because you've already wiped out that alpha response so that again you don't get a hypertensive crisis. And then another classic exam scenario is if a patient with a pheo has like intra-op hypertension, let's say like their blood pressure just shoots up to like 250 over 160 or something ridiculous. For those patients, you again want to consider giving like an alpha blocker like phentolamine. Alternatively, you can also give a nitroprusside on exams. Although nitroprusside, I guess since I mentioned it, one like dovetail question from nitroprusside is, let's assume a patient has been on like a nitroprusside drip for a long while, and then they get like a lactic acidosis, and then they become like unresponsive. Hopefully you're thinking about a cyanide poisoning with that, right? Remember, nitroprusside has a lot of cyano groups, so you can precipitate a cyanide poisoning. And classically for that, you want to treat with like ammonitrate and like thiosulfate, right? Yes, you want to treat with ammonitrate and thiosulfate. Again, this is a podcast. Yeah, I have some general ideas of what I want to discuss, but some things just crop up in my mind as I give these presentations. So, you want to give ammonitrate because the ammonitrate will convert like your hemoglobin to meth hemoglobin, basically, to like iron in the 3+ form. And then that iron in the 3+ form will complex with the cyanide, and then the thiosulfate will form thiocyanate, and then you can get rid of it. I think you can get rid of it in like your urine or something like that. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient that has like unrelenting hypertension, and they have like a hypokalemia on labs, like their potassium is like 3, and then they have like a bicarb of like 28, so they have like a metabolic alkalosis. This should get you thinking about Kohn syndrome, right? So like primary hyperaldosteronism, right? So this will likely be like an adrenal cortical tumor. So again, don't make a mistake here. In Kohn syndrome, the tumor that's making the aldosterone is in the adrenal cortex, okay? It will likely be arising from like the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex. Contrast that with a pheochromocytoma that can also, again, cause like the unrelenting hypertension. But that tumor will be more of like an adrenal medullary tumor, okay? So please don't make those mistakes. Remember, the adrenal medulla arises from neurocrest. The adrenal cortex does not arise from neurocrest. So how do you make the diagnosis of Kohn syndrome, right? If you suspect Kohn syndrome, you will classically want to, you know, measure the plasma levels of aldosterone, measure the plasma levels of renin, right? And then you calculate something called the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. If it's more than 20, that is pathognomonic for primary hyperaldosteronism. Although you don't stop there, right? The thing is, you want to sort of like, I mean, for every screening test, there's almost always a confirmatory test in medicine, right? So for these patients, after you've measured the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio and it's more than 20, you would want to confirm those results with something called like a salt suppression test. So you basically give those people a salt load. Usually, if you give a person a salt load, right, that will cause like intravascular volume expansion. So that should ideally decrease your production of aldosterone. But if you have a failure of aldosterone to suppress with the administration of a salt load, that is confirmatory for Kohn syndrome. So the next thing you do after that is to do a CT scan to basically localize the source of the lesion, okay? And if you do a CT scan and let's say you find like an adrenal adenoma that is making all this aldosterone, then you've basically made your diagnosis there. But here is where you really want to be careful on exams. The thing is, if a patient has Kohn syndrome can arise from an adrenal adenoma, but Kohn syndrome can also arise from adrenal hyperplasia, right? So like adrenal cortical hyperplasia. So the thing is, let's assume you're like, ooh, I just saw an adenoma. I've done the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. It's more than 20. I've done a CAT scan and I see this, you know, just this nice classic adenoma in the right adrenal gland. And you're like, okay, time to go ahead and resect this right adrenal gland, fix this patient's problems and send them on their way. That is a bad idea. Before you take a patient to surgery for Kohn syndrome, one thing you definitely want to do is to do something called adrenal vein sampling. Yes, Divine, why would I want to do adrenal vein sampling? The thing is, think about it. Let's say, what if the right adrenal adenoma you're seeing is a non-functioning adenoma, but you actually have hyperplasia in the left adrenal gland that is actually causing the Kohn syndrome? Well, if you just cut out that person's right adrenal gland and you're like, wait, this person's problem is it's not fixing so much. And then you're like, oh no, now I have to cut out their left adrenal gland as well. That will obviously not be a good thing, right? And again, there'll probably be a lawyer that'll be very willing to collect your medical license under those circumstances. So the thing you always do before you take a patient to surgery, for Korn syndrome is, I mean, you'll first start them on like an aldosterone receptor antagonist, right? So like spironolactone or eplerenone, right? To sort of like hold them over till surgery. And then before you do the surgery, you actually want to do like sort of like a localization sort of business, right? So the thing you do for those patients is you check the adrenal vein on both sides to see the site that has higher levels of aldosterone. That helps you sort of like localize that, okay, this is the adrenal side that is overproducing this aldosterone, so that you are going after the right adrenal gland, you are doing the right adrenalectomy, okay? And again, you definitely want to do that before you go to surgery. In fact, I will talk about another venous-like structure, probably in this podcast or in the next podcast that targets like the medicine board's IT step 3, when I continue discussing endocrine, when we get to like pituitary problems with like the sampling the inferior petrosella sinus. That's one other thing I'll talk about. That's like another nice localization tool you can use in endocrine that classically shows up on exams. And remember, I said that if a patient has Korn syndrome, right, their plasma aldosterone to renin ratio will be more than 20. The thing is, you also want to compare this with a patient that has like fibromuscular dysplasia, right? So that'll be like a young female that has unrelenting hypertension that is like not responsive to like three different antihypertensives. And you may hear like a brewery when you like a flank brewery when you auscultate the abdomen. Alternatively, it can be an old guy with renal artery stenosis, right? Those people also have like a flank brewery. Although if they don't give you that flank brewery on exams, they may give you like the fundoscopic finding of arteriovenous leaking. That's classic for renal artery stenosis. Remember, if a patient has renal artery stenosis, right, they are not perfusing the afferent arterioles very well, so their GG cells will begin to freak out, so they will release a ton of renin. In addition to releasing a ton of renin, they will also release a ton of aldosterone, right? Because remember, renin is like the gatekeeper to the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. So in renal artery stenosis, in fibromuscular dysplasia, you make a ton of renin. That renin will convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1, and then the endothelial cells in your lungs, right, around like your pulmonary capillaries, will convert that angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, and then that angiotensin 2 will go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex, and increase the release of aldosterone. So your renin will go up, but your aldosterone will go up at the same time as well. So your plasma aldosterone to renin ratio usually will be less than 10 in the setting of renal artery stenosis and fibromuscular dysplasia. Contrast this with Korn syndrome again, where that ratio is more than 20. So actually, in Korn syndrome, your aldosterone level is high. And because your aldosterone is high, you're reabsorbing sodium in the distal nephron, reabsorbing fluid at the same time, you become hypertensive. So your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is actually dialed down. So your levels of renin are actually low in the setting of Korn syndrome. That is why your plasma aldosterone to renin ratio is more than 20 if you have a Korn syndrome. Now, let's, I guess this podcast has gone on for more than an hour, but there's some other high yield stuff I think I want to get through today. So I'm going to just keep going. So I'll just give you a bunch of clinical scenarios and then you tell me what the most likely diagnosis is. And actually, let's go ahead and do it. So let's assume you get a question about this point just keeps nagging in my mind. Let me just go ahead and discuss it right now before I go to these scenarios, right? So if a patient has Addison's disease, right, this is almost like a freestyle podcast. I don't just show up and like start like talking. It's a freestyle podcast, but I also did some preparation before I started with this rendition, and all these things, I promise you, they are very high yield to know for the exams that this podcast is targeted towards. So back to the story. So but I want it to be conversational, so it can be something you can just listen to and just learn as you're like driving home from a long day at work or taking a shower or working out at the gym or something. So if a patient has Addison's disease, right, that's also known as primary adrenal insufficiency. So the adrenal glands don't work. If your adrenal gland is not working, your zona glomerulosa, fasciculata, and reticularis is not working, right? So for those people, they will obviously have low levels of aldosterone, right? And they will also have low levels of cortisol, right? So they will have like a mineralocorticoid and a glucocorticoid deficiency. So for those patients, you'd want to treat them with like fludrocortisone to replenish the mineralocorticoids that are missing. And you would also want to treat them with a glucocorticoid to replenish the cortisol that they are missing. Now, contrast this with a patient that has a secondary adrenal insufficiency, right? So let's assume a patient has, let's say they have like a pituitary adenoma that is like sort of like growing and causing a decreased production of ACTH at the level of the anterior pituitary. If people are not making ACTH, right, those people would have trouble making enough cortisol. Right, so they will have a glucocorticoid deficiency, but shockingly, they will actually not have a mineralocorticoid deficiency. So, why is that? The reasoning behind that is, remember, your zona glomerulosa is actually not under the control of ACTH. It's actually under the control of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. Okay, so if you have primary adrenal insufficiency, your adrenal gland is gone. Whether your renin angiotensin system works, it doesn't matter. You have a glucocorticoid and a mineralocorticoid defect. But if you have secondary adrenal insufficiency, where the problem is more upstream at the level of the anterior pituitary, your adrenal glands are working just fine. It's just like the fasciculata and reticularis that will not work well because you are not stimulating them with ACTH. But your renin angiotensin aldosterone system will be working well and good. Okay, so for those people, you actually do not need to give them fludrocortisone. You just need to give them glucocorticoids if they have a secondary adrenal insufficiency. Okay, so let's jump to a few scenarios, and I guess we'll probably round this up so this does not go on for much longer. I'll pick up from the other things I wanted to discuss in the next podcast that's targeted towards these exams. So what if you get a question about like a 4 foot tall female? Okay, that has never had menses and she has like recurrent pyelonephritis. Hopefully this gets you thinking of Turner syndrome, right? Remember, these people are 45XO. You may ask, like, Divine, why do they have primary menorrhea? Why are they not having menses? Well, they have streak ovaries, right? So if you have streak ovaries, right, you're not going to have menses in the first place. And you may ask, Divine, why do they have recurrent pyelonephritis? I'm just using that to tie in the fact that patients with Turner syndrome, right? If you see recurrent like urinary tract infections, you really want to think about horseshoe kidney, right? So remember, those people, like the inferior poles of their kidneys remain fused, right? So it sort of stays stuck under the inferior mesenteric artery in embryology, right? So those people can get like recurrent or urinary tract infections with that. I guess what are some other classic things that are associated with Turner syndrome that you want to know for these tests? You want to know that patients with Turner syndrome tend to get like bicuspid aortic valves, right? So if they describe like a systolic ejection murmur in a patient with Turner syndrome and they're like 45, 50 years old, like basically like early aortic stenosis, think about a bicuspid aortic valve with those. And remember that having bicuspid aortic valve actually increases your risk for aortic dissection or any of the other like acute aortic syndromes, right? Bicuspid aortic valve, for some reason, it increases your risk of like aortopathy that can ultimately lead to like an aortic dissection. So that's just one of those weird things you may also see in Turner syndrome. Now, patients with Turner syndrome can also get like coarctation of the aorta, right? So classically, you'll see like upper extremity hypertension and low extremity hypotension, right? And then if you do like a chest x-ray, you may see like that classic three sign, okay? That's on that classic association with Turner syndrome. And the thing is, right, these people, patients with Turner syndrome, they are hypogonadal, right? But the thing is, they have more of a hypergonadotropic hypogonadism, right? And the reason that's the case is because the ovaries are not working, they are not making estrogen. If they are not making estrogen, there's no negative feedback at the level of the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary, right? So their levels of GnRH and FSH and LH will all be high, okay? So they will have a hypergonadotropic. So their gonadotropins are high, but their estrogens are low, right? So they are hypogonadal, but they are hypergonadotropic, okay? Those tropic hormones for the gonads will be elevated because there's no negative feedback. And the thing is, right, if a patient has Turner syndrome, right, they will have like underdeveloped breasts, like very underdeveloped secondary sexual characteristics, right? Because again, they're not making estrogen. In fact, I will tell you this, because these imenorrhea questions and all that stuff. They love to mess with people's heads by telling you, oh, they have like Tanner 1 breasts and they have no pubic or axillary hair. Let me just give you a simple trick that makes the analysis very easy. Basically, if a patient does not have pubic or axillary hair, right off the bat, you should begin to think about disorders where they either have low levels of testosterone or they have testosterone and it's not effective. For example, like an androgen insensitivity syndrome. But if a patient has underdeveloped breasts or like, I'll say primary like underdeveloped breasts, so like Tanner 1 breasts, you really want to think more about like having like an estrogen deficiency. So under those circumstances, you want to begin to think about situations where estrogen may be low, right? So for example, if a patient had like Turner syndrome, that would be a cause of like primary menorrhea with like Turner 1 breasts, for example. So let's jump to some other scenarios, right? So what if you have like a 4.0 GPA, like female athlete that has a primary menorrhea, right? So this will be more of like, you know, like a functional hypothalamic insufficiency. Because the thing is, if you're working out a ton or you're under like tremendous amounts of stress, guess what that does to your HPG axis? It shuts it down, okay? And when your HPG axis is shuts down, right, your GnRH levels will be low, your FSHLH levels will be low, your estrogen levels will be low, right? So those people can get like basically like a hypothalamic amenorrhea, okay? Another classic, scenario, let's assume a patient has like breasts. So they have like Tanner 3, Tanner 4 breasts. They have like a vagina, although it's like a blind-ending vagina. But you do an ultrasound, you don't find the uterus, and you don't see any pubic or axillary hair. If you see this, I really hope you're thinking about androgen insensitivity syndrome. So this is kind of like a complex disorder, tends to screw with people's heads on tests. So let me sort of talk about it in some detail, right? So if you have AIS, you're genotypically male, but you're phenotypically female, okay? So these people actually have like a 46XY karyotype, okay? The problem is these people are making testosterone, but their testosterone is just not working. Okay, so if their testosterone does not work, guess what? They wouldn't have anything for 5-alpha reductase to act on to convert the testosterone to DHT. So if they're not making DHT, the external genitalia will not virilize, so it will go down the default female pathway. Okay, so that's why they'll have like external female genitals. But these patients will not have a uterus, right? Because remember, these people are genotypically guys, so they have a testes. And because they have a testes, they are making anti-Müllerian hormone, right? And that anti-Müllerian hormone will kill the Müllerian duct and everything that's derived from it, right? So, like, the uterus will be gone, their fallopian tubes will be gone as well. Now, you may ask, Divine, why would these people have breasts? Well, the reason they will have breasts is because they have aromatase. So that aromatase will take their testosterone and convert it to estrogens. And that estrogen would help with the development of breasts. Okay, so and these people actually have no axillary hair because again they have testosterone. Remember, I told you a telltale sign that you either have a testosterone deficiency or testosterone is not doing its job, right? You have like a functional testosterone deficiency, which is what you have with AIS, is having the absence of axillary or pubic hair. Okay, these people will actually not have axillary or pubic hair. And I guess to sort of tee things up here, what if you got a question about a patient that has, you know, they have breasts, they have like a blind ending vagina, you do an ultrasound, you actually spot some nice looking ovaries, but you don't see like a uterus or you don't see fallopian tubes. You'd want to think about Müllerian agenesis for that. I believe that's also known as Meyer-Rokitansky-Kosterhauser syndrome, or Müllerian agenesis for short. Basically, these people just, for some bizarre reason, just don't develop the Müllerian duct, right? So if you have Müllerian agenesis, everything that's derived from the Müllerian duct, right? So like the upper two thirds of the vagina, the uterus, the fallopian tubes don't develop. Remember, your ovaries are not embryologically derived from your Müllerian duct. So those people will have ovaries, and guess what? If you have ovaries, you have estrogen. If you have estrogen, guess what? You have breasts, okay? So those people have breasts. They just have no uterus. Now, what if you get a question about someone that has phenotypically developed as a girl, And then, like, over like a 1 year period in puberty, they just rapidly begin to virilize. And then, like, over like a 1-2 year span, they almost quickly become males. If you see that, you want to think about 5-alpha reductase deficiency, right? I mean, like, you've probably heard of this, I think it's like a Spanish term, I think it's like huevedoches. It's a relatively common problem in, I don't want to butcher this, but it's like either like a central or a south, or it's like some kind of like South or Central American country. Basically, they have like the 5-alpha reductase deficiency. Remember, 5-alpha reductase helps you convert testosterone to DHT. And DHT is primarily responsible for the virilization of your external genitalia, right? So if you see those kinds of, if you see that kind of problem, think about that deficiency. But you may say, Divine, okay, if they develop as females all through their lives until puberty, why do they suddenly become male at puberty? The reasoning behind that is at puberty, you secrete just ridiculous amounts of testosterone. So those ridiculous amounts of testosterone just basically force virilization. Okay, so it doesn't matter even if they don't have DHT, they just become virilized with a super high levels of testosterone that characterize puberty. And then just to throw you a bone here, what if you get a question about a newborn with ambiguous genitalia, right? If you see a newborn with ambiguous genitalia, hopefully that gets you thinking about congenital adrenal hyperplasia, right? That classically arises from a 21 hydroxylase deficiency. Now, what if you get a question about a lady, let's say she's had menses in the past, but let's say, you know, she had like a DNC, like a dilation and curettage, like a year ago, and then she's no longer having menses. For those patients, you want to think about Asherman syndrome, right? So Asherman syndrome, basically, if let's assume you have like a DNC, and let's say whoever did the DNC, like, you know, maybe scrubbed a little too hard, you can basically strip off the basal endometrium, right? So you basically have nothing to regenerate the endometrial cavity, okay? So these people, classically, you would want to go ahead and like lyse. The buzzword you're looking for treatment on exams is something called like hysteroscopic lysis of adhesions, because those people basically form a lot of scar tissue in their ovary and their uterus along the endometrial lining. So generally, the way you want to treat these people is, you know, you go ahead and lyse those adhesions, and then you give them estrogen to sort of build up the endometrium, and then they can return to like fertility, and they can start having like normal menstrual cycles again. One thing I would say here is they may give you like an experiment style question on these exams and tell you that, oh, if a patient like they may give you this thing called like the progesterone withdrawal challenge test, right? And then I mean, I can't really think of a way they would design a question, but I have certainly seen this tested, where you're sort of like supposed to deduce like, oh, if a patient has Asherman syndrome, how would they respond? So let's assume they have Asherman syndrome that has not been treated. How would they respond to like a progesterone withdrawal or challenge test? The thing is, they will actually not have the withdrawal bleed, because again, the thing is, when you give progesterone and withdraw it, you will get bleeding if you have a built up endometrium. Right? So if that basal endometrium is gone, you're not going to build up the endometrium in the first place. So there's nothing for progesterone to stabilize and then for you to have like bleeding when you withdraw that progesterone. So they will have a negative response to that challenge. Contrast that with a patient that has PCOS, right? In PCOS, those people, they are secreting a ton of estrogen, but they don't have much of progesterone, like enough progesterone around. So those people, if you actually do like that progesterone withdrawal challenge, because they have hyperestrogenism, they have like this super built up endometrium, if you give them progesterone and withdraw it, they will actually have a withdrawal bleed. So make sure you can interpret progesterone withdrawal challenge tests in the context of these diseases like PCOS and Asherman syndrome. I can really see them like sort of like saying, oh, in a QSTEM, like, oh, the progesterone withdrawal challenge test did not give any like withdrawal bleeding. And then they will give you like maybe like 4 or 5 options where of those 5 options, like 4 of them have like a positive test and then 1 has a negative test. And then you sort of have to like reason through like, oh, for this disorder, this is what will happen. For this disorder, this is what will happen, right? So just sort of keep those things at the back of your mind. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that has, again, stopped menstruating, and let's assume they're a patient with like schizophrenia. or I guess a diabetic gastroparesis, why would they stop having menses, right? So these people likely have are likely taking, you know, some kind of dopamine antagonist, right? So if your patient has schizophrenia, they are probably taking like an antipsychotic like risperidone or something, right? Remember, these things are dopamine antagonists. And remember that normally, dopamine's job is to inhibit the release of prolactin, okay? In fact, think about dopamine as prolactin inhibiting factor. So if you're taking a dopamine receptor antagonist, your levels of prolactin will go up because you are blunting the effects of dopamine. So you will have hyperprolactinemia. Remember, that's classically associated with risperidone on tests. So you get hyperprolactinemia, and prolactin suppresses the HPG axis, right? So you'll stop having menstrual cycles. And with regards to diabetic gastroparesis, right, remember, one treatment is metoclopramide, right? Metoclopramide is a dopamine antagonist, so you can also get hyperprolactinemia because, again, you're effectively shutting down the tuberoinfundibular pathway that relates to dopamine. Now, obviously, you want to potentially, you know, maybe stop these medications and the problem will sort of fix. Now, what if you get a question about no menses in a woman that has like tunnel vision? Right, so this is basically like a bitemporal, like a heteronymous hemianopsia. For these patients, right, they likely have like a pituitary adenoma, right? That's you know, compressing the optic chiasm, causing those visual field defects. But the reason they've stopped menstruating is, again, they probably have like a prolactinoma, right? Remember, prolactinomas, it's like a pituitary adenoma. It's not a secret. It's a pituitary adenoma that's making a ton of prolactin. Okay. In general, the way you make that diagnosis is, you know, you measure the levels of prolactin, right? It will classically be elevated. And then after you detect the prolactin elevation, you then go ahead and, you know, do like an MRI of the pituitary gland and you'll see the adenoma. And I'll tell you this. I'll say like 99.9% of the time, choosing surgery is the wrong answer for the treatment of a prolactinoma. In general, for prolactinomas, you explore medical management first. Medical management almost always works and like shrinks a prolactinoma in most people, right? So you want to choose a dopamine. Remember, I just told you that dopamine shuts down the release of prolactin, right? So you want to give a dopamine agonist like cabergoline or bromocriptine. Those are very nice drugs for the treatment of our prolactinomas. Although, if you got an evil exam question where cabergoline was an answer choice and bromocriptine was an answer choice, pick cabergoline over bromocriptine. Cabergoline is better tolerated over bromocriptine. Now, if, for example, though, let's say you've tried medical therapy, it's not working, you know, then you can try resecting the prolactinoma. And the boss phrase you're looking for in exams for resecting pituitary adenomas in general is something called a transsphenoidal resection, okay? That's the buzzword you're looking for in tests. Now, what if you get a question about a 39-year-old female, you know, she has no menses, like over the past 2-3 years, she has no menses, and she has a history of like type 1 diabetes, she has a history of like Addison's disease, so that's like primary adrenal insufficiency. For those people, you want to think about, you know, like a premature ovarian failure. So they basically had like autoimmune destruction of their ovaries, essentially. Because remember, right, you're not supposed to, you know, you're not supposed to be menopausal before the age of 40, right? So 39-year-old female, this is likely premature ovarian failure. And classically, we'll present on exams in a patient that just has like a very strong autoimmune predisposition, right? So like autoimmune adrenalitis, autoimmune insulitis, that's like type 1 diabetes and stuff like that. So for those patients, think about premature ovarian failure. And again, this would be another good example, just like Turner syndrome, of hypergonadotropic hypogonadism. Okay, because the ovaries are not working, their levels of GnRH, FSH, LH will all be high. Now, what if you get a question about a, you know, patient that has no menses, and let's assume they recently got like a total thyroidectomy for follicular thyroid carcinoma. Remember, this is one of those rare thyroid cancers that usually doesn't spread to lymph nodes, usually spreads hematogenously, right? For those patients, I really, really hope you're thinking about hypothyroidism that's causing hyperprolactinemia, right? So remember, if you resect the thyroid gland, well, bye-bye thyroid hormone. If you don't have thyroid hormone on board anymore, right, your levels of TSH will go up, your levels of TRH will go up, right? So thyrotropin-releasing hormone. One other term you can use to describe thyrotropin-releasing hormone is prolactin-releasing factor, Okay, so if your thyroid hormone is low, so if you're hypothyroid for any cause, your TRH will go up. If your TRH goes up, you will increase the release of prolactin. And if you increase the release of prolactin, well, guess what? You will shut down your HPG axis, and you will also stop again having a menstrual cycles. And in general, if you treated the hypothyroidism, the condition should technically resolve. Now, what if you got a question about, I guess this is sort of related to like losing menstrual cycles, but let's assume like you get a question about a lady that just delivered. Let's say she had like really bad placenta previa, had like a ton of bleeding, and then she cannot lactate, right? So she cannot breastfeed her baby. You want to think about Sheehan syndrome, right? So these people have potentially had like a pituitary necrosis, if you may, because of the blood loss. So they basically had like almost like an ischemic stroke. I think of Sheehan syndrome as an ischemic stroke of the pituitary gland versus pituitary apoplexy, that I think more of like a hemorrhagic stroke of the pituitary gland. So this patient in this case has a Sheehan's syndrome. Now, what if you get a question, about a hirsute female, has a BMI of like 37 and she's having trouble becoming pregnant? It's a pretty classic question, right? You want to think about PCOS. Please don't get this wrong on an exam ever. Okay, this is PCOS. Remember, PCOS, right? It's actually something that you don't necessarily need imaging to make the diagnosis. You can actually make the diagnosis like super clinically. In fact, there's like three diagnostic criteria. You just need to meet two out of three, and boom, the diagnosis has been made, right? So, one of the criteria is like seeing polycystic ovaries on ultrasound. Another one is, seeing like signs of hyperandrogenism, so like really bad acne, like nodulocystic acne, or like hirsutism. And then the third criteria is like evidence of an ovulation, right? So like amenorrhea and stuff like that. So if you see that, think about PCOS. And if you meet two out of those three criteria, you've made your diagnosis. Now, you want to be careful here though. If you see like kind of like a similar presentation to what I just mentioned, but you see it like rapidly progressive over like a very short period of time, sort of think about more of like, some tumor maybe in the adrenal gland that's making like DHEAS, okay, that is causing that hyperandrogenism. So maybe like, or it could also be like a Leydig cell tumor, for example. In general, for PCOS, you pursue multimodal treatment, right? So you weight loss, that can help with like the insulin problems that they tend to have. If they have like diabetes, you want to go ahead and give them metformin. In fact, there are some patients with PCOS that they're like, oh, they have infertility, and give them metformin, and that actually like fixes their infertility. But on exams though, if a patient has infertility and they desire pregnancy and they have PCOS, you want to go ahead and give them clomiphene. Clomiphene is a SERM that helps with promoting fertility. About 75 to 80% of women with PCOS that take clomiphene, they actually have a return to fertility. And then if the woman is worried about like the hyperandrogenism, like the hirsutism and all that stuff, you can give them like OCPs, that can help. You can also give them spironolactone. Spironolactone inhibits an enzyme known as 5-alpha reductase, but it does that in the skin, and it really helps with that hirsutism. Now, if a patient with long history of PCOS has like vaginal bleeding, on exams, your next step in management for those patients is to do an endometrial biopsy, because they could potentially have endometrial cancer, right? Remember, one of the cardinal features, it's not part of the diagnostic criteria, but it's one of the cardinal features of PCOS, is hyperestrogenism, like unopposed hyperestrogenism. So that can increase their risk of endometrial hyperplasia and endometrial cancer. So you want to go ahead and do an endometrial biopsy for them, even if they are not, even if they are like 37 years old, for example. You want to go ahead and do an endometrial biopsy, because they will try to mess with your head on exams and say, oh, usually the people who do endometrial biopsies for are people that are more than 50. No. If you have like very big risk factors, like if you have PCOS or you're like super obese and you have like vaginal bleeding and you're less than 50, even less than 40, doesn't matter, go ahead and do endometrial sampling for those people to make sure they don't have endometrial cancer. Now, what if you get a question about like a 6-foot tall guy that has like small testicles and has gynecomastia and has like difficulty getting his wife pregnant? This is pretty classic Klinefelter's, right? Your next step in diagnosis usually is to get a karyotype. You will detect like 47XXY. Okay, they have like an extra X chromosome. So they'll have like a bar. So if you see like a bar body, so they give you a question, they say, oh, they did like genetic analysis, they saw like a bar body in a guy. That's Klinefelter syndrome on exams. That's just good test-taking strategy right there. Now, what if you get a question about an immigrant that is having trouble, you know, getting his wife pregnant and his immunization history is unknown? Think about mumps under those circumstances. Remember, right, mumps can cause like an epididymo or orchitis, right? So you can basically nuke the testicles under those circumstances, and that can cause infertility. I mean, if your testicles ain't working, then, well, bye-bye sperm. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a guy with hemoglobin A1C of 9, okay, that is having trouble getting his wife pregnant, and then they tell you that, oh, you do a physical exam and you see skin hyperpigmentation. For these patients, you really want to think about, so you're seeing hemoglobin A1C of 9, that's diabetes, and you're seeing skin hyperpigmentation, right? So like bronze diabetes, that should hopefully get you thinking about hereditary or hemochromatosis. Remember, those people can have deposition of iron in their pancreas, right? So they can get diabetes from that because they're no longer making insulin. They can also have deposition of iron in their hearts. They can get restrictive cardiomyopathy with that. Although they could technically also get a dilated cardiomyopathy. And then they can deposit iron in their livers and get cirrhosis, right? Alternatively, they can also deposit that iron in their testicles, and they can get like testicular atrophy and infertility with that. So that's why I brought that up here. Remember, the way you treat hereditary hemochromatosis is to phlebotomy, right? So you basically like bloodlet those patients, and that will help with that iron overload state. Remember, classically on exams, your first step in diagnosis is to go ahead and check their levels of ferritin. Their ferritin will be very high, okay? And then you can confirm the test by doing like some genetic analysis for the HFE gene mutation. And I guess to sort of round this up, let me just talk about like, you know, hypogonadism in guys. I feel like I've been focusing on women for the most part. Let me give the guys some love here. So, in terms of like hypogonadism in males, right? So it may present as like, you know, like erectile dysfunction or like low libido and stuff like that. Usually the way you sort of make your diagnosis, you know, check the total levels of testosterone in the morning. If it's low, then you have your diagnosis there. If it's sort of like borderline, you can do something called like a free testosterone level. So actually, if your total testosterone level is not diagnostic, go ahead and check a free testosterone level. That will help you make your diagnosis. And I mean, in general, you can do like testosterone replacement therapy for these people. You can give it as like, you can give like the testosterone as a patch. Actually, in my residency program, we just had a discussion on like erectile dysfunction and stuff like that. It was actually pretty useful. Okay, so because this is something you encounter a lot in primary care, and many people don't know how to treat it. They don't even know how to work it up. But guys will not come off and say that, oh, they have erectile dysfunction, right? So it's just one of those things. If you're going into internal medicine, it's just one of those things you want to keep in your back pocket, because it's something that, again, guys will not share if you don't ask. So ask about these things at primary care visits, and you'll be surprised at how many guys will say, oh yeah, I'm having trouble getting it up during intercourse and all that stuff, right? And you may want to sort of pursue some diagnostic testing with them. Okay, and I guess like, you know, like someone is, before you start treating testosterone deficiency, right? You want to, you know, sort of get a CBC first, you know, check their hematocrit. Because remember, testosterone replacement can actually cause erythrocytosis, right? So you want to sort of have like a baseline CBC. Another thing you also potentially want to do is to, you know, check, have a baseline PSA level. Because remember, testosterone can drive prostate cancers, right? In fact, that's why some prostate cancers, especially like the metastatic kind, respond to androgen receptor blockers, right? Like bicalutamide and flutamide. Now, two more scenarios, and I promise we'll be done. What if a guy is having difficulty getting his wife pregnant, right? And he's like a super buff guy, has like large biceps, amazing abs, basically, think about a guy using anabolic steroids, right? Usually, those people will have like testicular atrophy on exam. That's like the classic thing they put on in a Q-STEM. And then the very last scenario, what if you get a question about a guy, you know, comes in, says he has trouble getting up in during intercourse, but he has like morning erections, right? This is like a psychogenic erectile dysfunction. That's a very classic exam question. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I'll pick up from here in the next podcast. But again, for those that have listened to the first one, listen to this one, compare and contrast, which one do you prefer? I feel like in this one, I was able to cover a lot more material comparatively in about the same amount of time. So I feel like this is probably a more efficient format because I'm talking about like pathophysiology, talking about treatment, talking about workup, but I'm just sort of interspersing many different things. So just let me know if you prefer this format. This is likely the format I'll stick with for the foreseeable future. And again, like I said, I'll keep making more and more of these podcasts to prepare for like the medicine boards, the medicine in training, and the USMLE Step 3 exam. So I wish you all the best. I'm really hoping and praying that the Lakers win their game tonight. And again, I'll throw it out there that I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, the Medicine in Training exam, and the Medicine Board exam. And I also do application prep. So ERAS applications for residency, MCAS applications for med school, mock interviews, and stuff like that. I have a lot of experience. I've tutored thousands of people in this life. So just reach out to me, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com, or you can email me through the website and I'll point you in the right direction. So have a wonderful day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless. Thank you.